Open Forum today, 2 hours of Open Forum, as a matter of fact, on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Open Forum is open to anyone. So if you are just listening for the very first time, you never even heard of this Catholic Answers thing before, and you are not a Catholic, and you don't even know much about Catholics, and you want to know something, you can call. Or if you are a lifelong Catholic, and you've got something that you've always wanted to know, or something you need help explaining to someone, you can call as well. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. And Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here. And when Jimmy is here, I always say, you know what? You can pretty much ask a question on anything you want. If you have a generally religious question, a philosophical question, a moral question, or even a question about the periodic table, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. In addition to being the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy also has written, well, he's got a lot of books, but I've got next to me here A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and his brand new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Doing well.
And you are a mysterious man. You have a mysterious podcast.
Live a life of danger. Everywhere I go, I stay a stranger.
I know that's got to be a lyric,
yeah,
but I can't think of what it is a lyric to.
Well, it's sometimes called Secret Agent Man.
Oh, Secret Agent Man, yes.
Yeah, for that.
Yes, I didn't understand that song when I was a kid. I didn't know why there was a Secret Agent Man.
He's a man who lives a life of danger.
Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow, though. So
yeah,
you
gotta
probably don't want to be that guy. but I mean, you're
that
also—
was Patrick McGoohan.
That's the singer of it?
No, he was the actor who played the secret agent.
Oh.
And then he became the prisoner.
Oh, right. Yeah, the prisoner, what a very odd show.
Yeah.
A very odd show. What's going on here?
I need to see the new number two to find out.
Yeah. Jimmy, you also do the podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
What's on the Mysterious World this week?
Somerton Man.
Oh, yeah, from Australia.
The greatest historical mystery of Australia. Somerton Man was a gentleman in the 1940s who passed away very mysteriously, and there's evidence he was a spy.
888-318-7884, the number here, 888-318-7884. We already got a bunch of calls, Jimmy, shall we?
Yeah, let's.
We'll make Patrick happy in New York. Fong in Vancouver, British Columbia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are starting the show off today, Fong. Your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, it's nice to meet you, sir.
Likewise.
I took a friend to the Abbey, and he met this priest, and he was so impressed about him. He went home. He told me that he said that I want to be happy like that man. I want to have what he has.
Uh-huh.
And his background is Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
So I want to buy him a book and so for him to read and to show him how to find happiness.
Okay.
Because I don't know what book to give him.
Well, there have been a lot of books written about Christianity and happiness. One of the things, like, for example, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Four Loves, where he talks about different types of love from a Christian point of view and how they can be understood and what their role in life is. And that could be helpful. Peter Kreeft has written a good bit about love and joy and happiness. One of his books that might benefit this gentleman is Heaven, The Heart's Deepest Longing, because that frames happiness in terms of the goal of the Christian life, which is getting to be with God in heaven for all eternity, and that how that corresponds to our heart's deepest longing. So you might find that those help him, but also the source of Christian happiness is Jesus, and so you might want to get him a book that talks more directly about Jesus. For example, Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic, you know, that lays out the basics of why one would want to be a Christian and why one would want to be a Catholic in particular. And it can help lead people towards faith in Jesus, who's the ultimate source of happiness. So rather than just a book about happiness, you might want a book about Jesus, the source of happiness for him.
Fong, how does that strike you?
I want him to be happy because he seems to be something that he needs. He needs. I want him to be happy because I know my happiness, and I know it lies in Jesus.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Why don't we, Marie, if we can send him a copy of Trent's book, Why We're Catholic, and hang on the line, Fong, and then you can look for those other books either by Peter Kreeft, his last name is spelled Kreeft, or by C.S. Lewis would also be very fine books. But it's a wonderful testament to the priest that this Buddhist man met, that the joy in the priest made this guy say, what does he have? I want that.
Yeah, it's good that Fong wants him to be happy. We should want everyone to be happy. Do what we can to help them.
Fong, thank you again for getting us started on such a joyful note. Let's go now to Connecticut. Oh, hey, I'm going to be in Connecticut, in New Haven, Connecticut, this weekend doing the fundraiser, the priest talent show for the Regina Caeli Academy there. So if you just check out...
There's a priest talent show?
Priest talent show,
so like you're going to have priests who tap have dance and tell jokes.
I don't know about tap dance, but they tell jokes, they perform music, they do all kinds of cool stuff.
Cool.
It's a lot of fun. So... And I'll be emceeing that. So if you're anywhere near New Haven, Connecticut, and you want to find out about that, just look up Regina Caeli Priest Talent Show and you'll come across it. So Jimmy in Connecticut is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Delighted to have you, Jimmy. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing me into the show. I have a question about, I'm an Orthodox Christian. I'm from Europe. Mm-hmm. I'm European, but I live here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I'm an Orthodox Christian, so I want to know, I'm a new Orthodox Christian. I'm pretty young, but I just want to know, do I have to be Catholic to be saved? Or I can be Orthodox Christian? Is that okay?
Well, the answer has a few different aspects to it. Jesus founded one church, and he gave that church certain attributes that he wanted it to have for the benefit of all of his followers. One of them is he gave St. Peter a special ministry with respect to the other apostles. Peter was the first pope. And when Peter passed on, that office was inherited by the Bishop of Rome. And so in order for a church to have all of the different things that Jesus wanted his church to have, it needs to have that ministry of St. Peter. It needs to be in communion with the Pope. Therefore, if a person knows that and you have evidence that that's the case, you know you should believe that, you know you should be in communion with the successor of Peter that Jesus appointed, then you need to be a member of that church. You need to say, I want to do what Jesus wants me to do. He wanted his followers to be part of a church that has the ministry of St. Peter, and so I need to be part of that church. And to knowingly and deliberately say, I don't care, I know Jesus wants that, and I just don't care, I'm not going to do that, then you're not accepting salvation on Jesus' terms. And that does jeopardize one's salvation. Having said that, there are many people in this world who don't know that that's what Jesus wanted. They may have heard the claim, but they haven't seen evidence for it. They don't personally believe it through no fault of their own. And as long as they otherwise do what they understand Jesus wants them to do, he won't deny them his grace because they're not deliberately refusing to do what they know he wants them to do. And so in those circumstances, people can be saved even though they're not members of the Catholic Church. That includes many, many Orthodox. Our Orthodox friends have almost everything that Jesus wants his church to have. The degree from a Catholic point of view that's missing in Orthodox churches is very, very, very small. They have a great richness of grace and faith and doctrine and the sacraments, but they don't have the ministry of St. Peter. And that's an issue from a Catholic point of view. So I would encourage you to keep listening, and we're happy always to answer questions. We have resources that can show you evidence for the Petrine ministry. And I would recognize you as a brother in Christ and hopefully maybe one day we'll have full unity, and we're happy to do what we can to assist.
Jimmy, thank you very, very much for that question. About to head to a break, but it's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. And be sure to visit our online shop where we've got a big sale going on at shop.catholic.com. Hundreds of faith-filled gifts for everyone on your list. Savings up to 70% in some cases. Plus, we've got $5 flat rate shipping in the continental U.S. Visit us today at shop.catholic.com. Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus. You can listen each week to the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, now available at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is HomeschoolConnections.com.
Dr. Doctor, featuring doctors Tom McGovern, Chris Stroud, and Andrew Mullally.
The number of people who are on government assistance expanded so much. Personally, I have patients in my office in tears saying, you know, I never thought of myself as somebody on government assistance. I just bought a new car. I can afford a brand new car, but I'm still on Medicaid.
Dr. Doctor, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and I really would love it if you'd join us on Monday. I always want to start kind of promoting this a little bit because on Monday we have the second of our recordings from Australia where we did live programs down there in front of an audience at Corpus Christi, at the Corpus Christi College Theater during the YB Catholic Conference from Evangelization Australia. So if you are in the neighborhood of a radio and you can tune in between our start and our finish, you'll hear some fine questions and just a good time being had with our brothers and sisters down in Australia. It's open forum this hour. Jimmy Akin right here in the studio with us, and your questions are welcome. 888-318-7884. Kevin in Cincinnati's next. Yeah, he's listening on 7:40 a.m. there. Hang on, Kevin. I'm having a little button trouble. Go ahead, Kevin. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Well, Kevin,
you
can add him next.
Nope.
Oh, I'm there. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead. Your question for Jimmy.
Okay. Hi, Jimmy. So I've been listening for about a year, and I'm Catholic. And obviously a question that comes up a lot is transubstantiation. And the way I see it, a lot of people, like, the hardest thing to accept about it is the, like, substance and accidents deal. And I feel like a really great answer to that, like, never comes up is, like Eucharistic miracles.
Well, okay, Kevin, no, that's fine. I'm going to let it go there. So, because we're having trouble hearing you, Kevin. So, what about the Eucharistic miracles? Why aren't we using those more to educate people as far as the real presence?
I think there are a few reasons. One is Eucharistic miracles that occur where, let's say, a host transforms visibly into human flesh or where the contents of the chalice transform visibly into human blood. There are a few things that, you do sometimes hear people appealing to those as evidence for the real presence. They tend not to be as helpful, though, in convincing people who don't already believe in the real presence. They may be signs that God may give from time to time that help confirm people in their understanding of the real presence. But if someone doesn't already believe in the real presence, they're not going to be as helpful for a few reasons. One of them that should just, as Catholics, give us reason for caution is these are not things that are that the Church says are definitive for our faith. They're not part of the essential content of our faith that Eucharistic miracles like that happen. What's definitive for our faith is what Christ says about the Eucharist.
I see, yes.
And so that's naturally the center of what we want to focus on in establishing our doctrine, not these auxiliary helps that may be present. But apologetically, the reasons they'll be less convincing to others than just what Jesus directly says, and you know how that's been understood by Christians down through history. Number one, most people don't have access to a Eucharistic miracle. They're sufficiently rare that for an ordinary person, you know, they can hear you claim that such a miracle occurred, but they can't go and see it for themselves. They certainly weren't there when it happened.
Right.
And so they aren't personal witnesses to these things. And that means it's going to have less value for them than something that is authoritative and they can have a personal experience of, like the words of Christ in the Gospels. Because they're not there at the moment, even if they went to, say, a church where a Eucharistic miracle has been preserved, they could always in their mind say, well, how do I know this isn't prestidigitation?
Right.
How do I know it's not some kind of trick? Because there have been people in the history of Christianity and of every religion and of no religion, there have been people who have performed trick miracles.
Yes.
Just recently over in Arizona, a bishop in Arizona called attention to a woman who was claiming that God was miraculously materializing roses as a sign of her apparitions are real. And guess what? On security camera, here's the woman surreptitiously ditching a rose in a room for other people to find and then proclaim it a miracle.
So people
will do that. That's an example of a Catholic doing that. Non-Catholics have done it too. I've mentioned before a Pentecostal preacher named Marjo Gortner, who grew up in the 50s and 60s. He was a child evangelist. He started preaching when he was like four. And he would have this powder when he got older. He'd have this powder that he'd put on his head, in his forehead, in the shape of a cross. And then as he would perspire, as he would preach, you know, kind of like Tim Staples gets really worked up with his Pentecostal background. Well, Marjo Gortner would do the same thing. Like a lot of Pentecostal preachers, he'd start to perspire and the powder that was initially not visible to the audience would turn red.
Oh,
and then he'd wipe it off with the perspiration. And people would come up to him later and say, Brother Gortner or Brother Marjo, for a few seconds, I saw you had a bloody cross on your forehead. And so there are, and similarly, there are people, you know, atheists who have done tricks to con people out of money. You know, some of the people involved in the spiritualist movement back in the 1900s did that with table rapping and things like that. So because people aren't there as personal witnesses when the Eucharistic miracle happens, if they don't already believe in the Eucharist, they will be able to say to themselves, how do I know there wasn't sleight of hand here? You know, they also probably don't have access to, DNA sequencing to show that this is even real human blood. And if so, does it contain Middle Eastern genetic markers like we would expect Jesus's to? And does anyone in the congregation have such blood? And there are all kinds of questions that can be asked. And for that reason, the church and apologists, for the most part, don't point to Eucharistic miracles as proof of the real presence. What proves it is the teaching of Jesus as proclaimed in the Gospels and the other New Testament books and the Church Fathers and by the Magisterium. That's the proof. These other things, when they genuinely happen, can play a confirmatory role, but they're not the primary evidence for it.
Kevin, thank you very, very much for that question. Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. Joseph in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Joseph, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, sir. My question has to do with a bracelet my buddy got me when he went to Disneyland.
Uh-huh.
It is, he said it was blessed by monks, and I guess my question is just if as a Catholic, am I allowed to accept that, or is that like worshiping an idol? I don't know if I'm asking that question correctly, but
okay. Well, let me ask you a couple of questions just to make sure I understand properly. You have this bracelet, and it's just got beads on it. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So it doesn't have like little idols on it or anything. It's just beads.
It is beads with some, looks like engraved writing, maybe, I don't know, it's not necessarily writing, but probably in different language. Maybe.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, to you, it doesn't have any connection. I mean, it doesn't symbolize a pagan deity to you, right?
No, sir. He gave me a little card with it, and it says just, the card says, work smoothly, lifetime peace.
Okay, well, work smoothly, lifetime peace, are noble sentiments. These monks, who he says blessed it. Now, I understand this came from Disneyland. I don't know that he got it blessed at Disneyland. If they were Jedi monks, I would say, you know, probably pass. But if they were Christian, if they were Catholic monks, then I see no problem here. Catholic monks, especially those who are priests, but even ones who aren't in some circumstances, can bless objects, and there's nothing wrong with that. And one wouldn't want to be superstitious about this bracelet and think, oh, because it's been blessed by monks, it's going to have magical automatic effects. When objects are blessed, it's essentially a prayer asking God to use the blessed object to help the person who uses the object. So it would be like asking God, please give your grace to anyone who wear to whoever wears this bracelet. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a noble sentiment. And if it was a Catholic monk who blessed it, and there's nothing otherwise objectionable about it, then wearing it's just fine, as long as you don't get superstitious about it.
Okay, Joseph?
Okay, great.
All right. God bless you, brother. Thank you very, very much for the call. Let's go to Travis in Georgia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Travis, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si.
Hi, Travis.
I want to be Catholic, but mm-hmm. I'm currently living with my parents, and they're Protestants, and it's a big no, and it's a big deal. And I believe everything that the church teaches. And I was just wondering, is there any ways y'all could suggest me to grow in my faith, as I'm not allowed to, like, go to Mass or anything like that, or if there's anything that would help me to get my heart closer to Jesus? So thank you so much for your help.
Yeah.
Catholic Answers. It's helped me so much.
Thank you, Travis.
Thank you. And please let us know whenever we can be of assistance. A few thoughts occur to me. Now, I don't know what, you know, restrictions there are in your house, but obviously, you know, even though you're not Catholic yet, you're obviously welcome to do Catholic devotions like the Rosary or other, you know, Catholic prayers. But if your parents find your Rosary, it may cause a big stink. So I don't know if you're allowed to do that in your current circumstances. If you're not, you know, reading Catholic books can also be a way to grow closer to God, whether it's a book, you know, that has like apologetics in it, or a book that's a spiritual nature, like a prayer book or things. But those are possibilities as well. Again, though, there's this issue of, you know, will that violate the domestic peace if, you know, they find these Catholic books? So that may be a problem as well. It seems to me you've already identified a great way to grow in the faith, which is through Catholic radio. You know, there are a variety of different programs. Some of them, like Catholic Answers Live, are more informational in nature, but there are others as well, like there are recordings that you can hear on Catholic radio online. I know you're using your app on your mobile device, but there are, like, you know, people saying the Rosary, people broadcasting Mass, people broadcasting homilies. There are lots of Catholic podcasts. And so it sounds to me like you've already identified a really great way. And I would encourage you to explore those. And one nice thing about those is, you know, they don't intrude on the domestic environment in the same way as a physical object, like a rosary or a book.
Right.
And so they may be less likely to provoke conflict in your home. And so in addition, there are Catholic forums online. I mean, Catholic Answers, for example, has, if you go to forums.catholic.com, there are other people who either are Catholic or are on the same journey or who are friendly to Catholics that you can talk with and have Christian fellowship with online. So all of those seem to me like possibilities.
Travis, what do you think?
That sounds great. Thank you so much for all your suggestions.
No problem.
Thank you very much for the call, Travis. We really, really appreciate that.
I sympathize with Travis because when I was becoming Catholic, I was in Arkansas, and at the time it was very low Catholic population, mm-hmm. and there was no Catholic radio, and there was no internet. And so it was really kind of a lonely process, and a lot of people I knew weren't favorable to Catholics. But today, we have all these new means to hook up with people, to connect with people at a distance, and that can make it really easier.
And I can assure you, a lot of listeners saying a prayer for you now, Travis, and God bless you in your as you approach the church in your time. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, stop settling.
Do you feel like you're settling in your life or relationships? We'll help you live life more abundantly.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin's right here with me, and it is Open Forum.
Right here with you, buddy.
We're right here with me, Jimmy. Jimmy's latest book, by the way, I got it right in my hand. That's the one that Tim was just talking about. The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get it in bulk if you like and share it with other folks at shop.catholic.com. The bulk price is
$3 a copy.
Unacceptably low is what I was going to say. Colleen in Kansas, you are up next. Your question for Jimmy, Colleen.
Hi. The question I have is on the passage in the Bible where Jesus stays back in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and after 3 days of searching for him, Mary and Joseph find him in the temple. Mm-hmm. I read in Mary Agreda's book, The City of God, that this was a test, sort of a test for Mary. Hmm. I'm probably not wording that absolutely correctly, but that's the impression I got from what it said. Hmm. My cousin once told my son that Jesus was just being disobedient, which I absolutely said no to that. Mm-hmm. But could you give me a little bit of a sort of an explanation about that passage? You know, like why that kind of happened, why he did that, because Mary seemed to like not know really where he was.
All right. All right. Well, so what happened there?
So this, we don't have full information on exactly what happened. We know that there was a party of people who traveled from Nazareth, including Jesus and his family, down to Jerusalem for Passover. That was a normal thing that happened every year. People from Nazareth would go down and they would travel as a group because, among other things, it was safer to do it that way, because there were brigands on the highway. I mean, they knew there's going to be travelers heading to Jerusalem, and so, and they're going to be bringing money and gifts and things like that. They're going to want to buy Passover lambs when they're there. So you find a lone traveler, they're easy pickings.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would travel in groups because it was safer. So you had all these people from Nazareth set out, and they go down to Jerusalem, and they celebrate the Passover, and then as a body, they leave. But if you've ever seen Home Alone, the movie
with I've seen it. Yeah, with Joe Pesci.
Kevin McCauley, yeah, or whatever it is.
Macaulay Culkin,
that's it, yeah. You know, they're doing their best to get a head count of all the kids and make sure before we all get on the plane, but there's an accident in the counting, and one of them gets left behind. And so he's home alone. Well, this is presumably what happened here. Now, Jesus didn't deliberately, from what we can tell, stay behind, because Luke is very clear. At the end of the story, he specifically says that Jesus went back to Nazareth and was obedient mm-hmm. to Joseph and Mary, and that's his way of signaling Jesus is not a disobedient child.
Right.
So if Mary and Joseph had said, let's all go back to Nazareth now, he would have gone. He wouldn't have disobeyed them.
Right.
But apparently there was some kind of miscommunication that happened with this big group of people where they thought Jesus was with them. Mary and Joseph thought that.
Yeah.
Luke tells us Mary and Joseph thought that. But in actuality, he wasn't. So it's basically kind of like the beginning of the movie Home Alone. Everyone thought he was with him, but he wasn't. And so once Jesus realizes he's alone in Jerusalem, that the Nazareth party is left without him, he effectively goes home, to the closest home thing in Jerusalem for him, the temple, his father's house. And so he spends time in the temple, and he expects his parents will know, okay, God is his father, he's going to be in his father's house. And it so takes Mary and Joseph about a day to get back to Jerusalem. I mean, it takes a day before they realize he's gone, another day before they get back, and then they spend a day searching for him. They finally find him in the temple, and he says, well, you could have made a beeline here.
Yeah.
That seems to be the most reasonable reconstruction of the evidence. It seems like he was left behind by accident when everybody thought he was with the party when, in fact, he wasn't.
And he went to the place where he thought they'd be looking for him.
Yeah.
Which was, yeah. Save them trouble. Colleen, thank you very, very much. Christoph is next in Winnipeg, Canada, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Christoph, your question for Jimmy.
My first time calling.
Well, we're happy to have you, Christoph. Yes, yeah. We are here.
Interesting story is in 2005, I actually went to the Catholic Answers State building. I had a tour
because
I lived in Tijuana. I thought that was really cool. Jimmy, you're one of my favorite apologists, so this is very nerve-wracking.
Oh.
This is my question. My wife and I have been married for 10 years, and we've had lots of problems having babies. Oh. I don't want to get emotional because this is hard.
Oh, sure.
We've lost 5 babies.
Hmm.
And we've had 3 ectopic pregnancies, and last month was our last one. And one of the problems we had is we were trying to decide what to do, and we were agonizing about our decision here and there, back and forth. And we ended up finally making a decision because she had lost one tube many years ago, and then we had to try to decide to save her tube. But I think my question is, I don't feel a lot of like willingness to have the physical intimacy at this time because I kind of feel hopeless about this because we seem to have lots of fertility issues and it's been making us depressed. And so I'm wondering, what can I do to overcome these things? And I mean, I pray often. I try to go to adoration. I go to Mass during the week. But it's been really affecting me more than it usually does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I kind of feel hopeless that 10 years and none of no children. And I guess, yeah, that's what my question is.
Well, I understand. I lost my wife many years ago, and we were not able to have children before she died, at least not that we know of. She might have had an early miscarriage that we didn't know about. And actually, part of me has secretly hoped that there will be a new child in heaven that I never got to know here on earth.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand what you feel. In terms of how to proceed, I would look at it a couple of ways. There are sort of three parties that are involved in the situation. One is the children that you've had and lost. Here's the good news. You brought new eternal beings into the world, and they are going to be there. And the church says, even though we don't know for sure, that we can hope that we know they're not going to suffer because they haven't committed any personal sins. And we may hope that they have the full glory of heaven. So that means you've brought new eternal beings into the world, however briefly they were here, but they have an infinite resurrection in front of them where they will not suffer, and there is great prospect of them having great joy for all eternity. And if they're in heaven and if you're in heaven, you're going to get to know them. And so even despite the tragedy in this life of losing those children, they're still the good of children. You still have children, and you may have great hope for the future. And so I would say that's something to think about to help keep perspective on this, because it counterbalances the tragedy of not being able to have a child right now and not being able to raise a child right now in this life. Even though that is a tragedy, it's also counterbalanced by the fact that there are new eternal creatures that you have brought into the world with your wife and with God, and they're in God's hands right now, and you can have great hope regarding them. And so even though it's understandable that, you know, when you engage in an activity and it's frustrating and cause, you know, can be painful, you may say, I just don't want to do that anymore, or I don't want to do that right now. That's understandable, but remember, it isn't all bad. You've got these great kids that you should be able to meet one day, and that will enjoy, hopefully, God's presence for all eternity, and certainly will not suffer. And so, so that positive aspect is something that I would keep in mind. Also, now the children are the first party. The second party is your wife. And when we marry someone, we have a duty towards that person, not just to give them children, but also to care for them emotionally and physically in terms of intimacy. And that's a mutual duty that St. Paul talks about. And it exists even among people who are infertile. Say they're past the age of having children, or they're just naturally infertile. They still have a duty to care for each other and be intimate with each other. And so think about your wife and think about her needs. And if she is wanting to, you know, be intimate on a particular occasion, take that into account and think about how much she's devoted to her relationship with you, how she committed to you, how you committed to her. Think about all of her good qualities, and including her good physical qualities, and be open to being intimate with her. The third party involved here on earth in the situation is you, and you have needs as well. You know, she's there to help care for your needs, including your need to be intimate. And one of the things about being intimate with your spouse is it is a comfort. And so even if you may say, well, it doesn't look like we're going to have a child, at least not right now, we can still comfort each other by being intimate with each other. And you can receive the benefit of being comforted and having that loving intimacy with your wife. And so those are the factors that I would think about. I'd think about your needs, I'd think about your wife's needs, and I would think about the good that is brought about even through a miscarriage. That there's the, as St. Paul says, the glory that's laid up for us in the next life is so great that the sufferings of this life are not worth comparing to it. And so even if there's a suffering of a miscarriage in this life, that means there's going to be a child who gets to be in the next life and who is never going to suffer and who may have great glory in their lives. And that's a great benefit that outweighs the suffering of the miscarriage in this life. So I hope those thoughts are helpful.
Christoph, thank you so much for
really
the call.
That's beautiful. Is there any kind of books that anywhere that talks about this stuff, like from a well-known, because I don't know how many about on this subject. I know a lot about stuff because I study a lot, but I don't know anything on this one. So.
Yeah, I know there have been books written about Christian miscarriage and how to process the situation. In fact, I'm sure there are a lot of books like that. I don't know any off the top of my head, but you know, if you did some searching online for Catholic miscarriage resources, especially if you look at newer ones that take into account the Church's doctrinal development regarding what happens when children pass on without baptism, those could be a benefit to you.
Thank you, Christoph. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're waiting for your call. Grab that line and get on board.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The best way to pray is simply to open our minds and our hearts to God, to allow His presence to begin to fill us, to restore us, to refresh us, to make us new. The best way to pray is simply to be aware of that presence and to say yes to it, to give fiat to that presence as our Blessed Lady did. In that way, we delight in prayer and God Himself delights in us.
Hey, we got 2 hours of Open Forum today, so don't worry about it. If you're on the line, we're going to get to your question, whether it's this hour or next. And if you haven't had a chance to dial yet, but you want to get your question addressed, there's plenty of time still to dial 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, one of the most Catholicist Catholic publishers in the universe, will be here. That's my new tagline for that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Angel in Anaheim's next. Angel's watching on Facebook. Your question for Jimmy, Angel.
Hi. The question I have is, lately, especially on social media, I've noticed that a lot of people are posting that the Tridentine Mass is the original, is what they're saying, and that we should go back to it. And I've also seen lately a lot of people posting that the Novus Ordo is not a valid, that it was invented in the 60s by a committee and all this stuff. So my question is, what do we take of that? Is that true? What can we do? What do we say?
Okay. So the idea that the Tridentine Mass is the original form of the Mass is just false. The Tridentine Mass, among other things, is celebrated in Latin, and Latin was not the original language in which the Mass was celebrated. The Mass was originally celebrated in Aramaic, and then it was celebrated in Greek. And in fact, even in Rome, it was celebrated in Greek for the first few centuries, because even though Latin was the native language, Greek was the international language in the West, and it wasn't for actually a few hundred years before you had a substantial number of Christians celebrating the Mass in Latin. So that just applies to the language. But what about the prayers being said, the form of the Mass? Well, the basic structure of the Mass has always been the same in all of the different rites of the Mass. And it's the same structure that we find in the so-called Novus Ordo Mass, or what's now called the ordinary form of the Mass in the Latin Rite. So the structure is the same, the basic structure. What about the individual prayers? Well, the prayers of the Tridentine Mass do not all go back to the time of the apostles. In fact, there's a book, we can chart how they progressed over the course of time. There's a famous book called The History of the Roman, I want to say the History of the Roman Rite. It's by Joseph Jungmann, or Jungmann, that describes for the individual prayers of the traditional form of the Mass, how they developed over time. And so it's simply not the case that this was the original form of the Mass. There were, in the early centuries, originally no fixed prayers that everybody had to say, which is why we got the differentiation into the different rites of the Mass that are used in different parts of the church. Like, in addition to the Latin Rite, the Byzantine Rite, and the Chaldean Rite, and the Syro-Malabar Rite, and so forth. It's because there weren't fixed prayers that everybody had to say in celebrating Mass that this diversification happened. So it was only later that the particular rites became stabilized. And so the idea that the traditional Latin Mass, or what's called the extraordinary form, the idea that that's the original form of Mass is just historically false. In terms of the idea that the current Mass is invalid because it was designed by a committee in the 60s, neither one of those has any relevance. Yeah, sure, there were multiple people who had input into the revision of the liturgy. And if you want to say that makes it designed by committee, well, it would be true. But you know what? Multiple people had input into the development of the Tridentine form of Mass. So if designed by committee means invalid, then that would invalidate the Tridentine form of the Mass too, because multiple people had input over the course of time into how it developed, including multiple popes. Committee of popes across time. Imagine that. Mm. In terms of the 1960s, while some bad stuff happened in the 1960s, God guides his church in all ages. Jesus said he was going to be with his church and guide his church in all ages. He said the Holy Spirit would guide his church. That applies till the end of the world, and thus it applies to the 1960s. And the bishops of the world at Vatican II called for some revisions in the Mass. They then turned the matter over to a smaller study group or committee, if you will, to propose specific changes. Some requests were made after the council for some additional modifications. Eventually, the successor of St. Peter himself, Paul VI, approved this rite of Mass, and it was received by the bishops of the world. If it had, God forbid, been invalid, the Holy Spirit would have made sure that a bunch of them noticed. And that didn't happen. You did not have the successors of the apostles saying, this is invalid, this is horrible, this is, they accepted it. They may have favored individual aspects of it, they may have liked some bits better than others, but they recognized it as valid. And so the Holy Spirit did not lead the bishops of the world, the successors of the apostles entrusted with the governance of Christ's church. He did not lead them to say, oh, this is invalid, we can't accept this. He led them to say, this is valid, we can accept this. And if that's what the Holy Spirit led the bishops to do as a body, that's what we need to do too.
Angel, thanks very much. I'm going to try to get everybody in if I can here. George in Tampa, Florida, listening to EWTN Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You're next, George. Your question, please.
Hi there. Guy called in a few minutes ago, Orthodox guy, who was talking about salvation and being Orthodox. And yeah. I had a couple of questions about St. Peter.
Okay.
I'm Orthodox, and so I believe that there's one church and that Christ founded on the rock of the faith that Peter proclaimed, not the person of Peter. But that aside, when I receive the mysteries or sacraments, for example, Holy Communion, Catholics believe that I'm receiving the body and blood of Jesus Christ. In other words, Catholics view Orthodox sacraments as totally, completely valid.
Right.
So what's the big problem there? And then number two, if it's the successor of Peter who has supremacy over the whole church, well, St. Peter was also the first bishop of Antioch, and he was the bishop of Antioch before he was the bishop of Rome. So why isn't the patriarch, current patriarch of Antioch, who also is the successor of St. Peter, the head of the entire church?
Okay.
And so I'll just hang up and listen to that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling, George, and you're welcome to call again. In terms of the sacraments, you asked what's the problem with the Orthodox sacraments, and there isn't one. Catholics accept that that Orthodox have valid sacraments, all seven of them, and I in fact cited that as an example of the riches of grace that are found in the Orthodox Church. So there's no problem with regard to the sacraments in the Orthodox Church. In terms of why the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter in a special way, it's the Patriarch of Antioch isn't. It's because, well, you'll also notice he was Patriarch of Jerusalem even before then.
Thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he moved to Antioch, and then he moved to Rome. And the reason that the successor of Peter is to be found uniquely in Rome is because that's where Peter was martyred. And that's where he appointed his successor. And so it's the and he went to Rome specifically because it was the capital of the empire and it would play a key role in evangelizing the empire. So that's why Peter went there. And that's why he left his successor there. And that's why the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter in a special way.
George, thanks very, very much for the question. I appreciate that. So Antioch is where now? Like,
well,
if I went to Antioch, where would I be?
There's more than one Antioch, but the one that's relevant here is what's called Antioch in Syria.
Oh, okay. Okay. And St. Paul went there?
Yes. It was St. Paul's home base for his evangelization efforts in the first, second, and third missionary journeys.
Okay.
So it's also the place we were first called Christians.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, right. In Antioch then, in Syria, now, that would have been part of the Byzantine Roman Empire. It would have been a Greek-speaking place. So that became part of the...
Well, Byzantine didn't exist yet, but it was a Greek-speaking place in the Roman Empire. But they also spoke Aramaic there.
Okay.
A dialect of Aramaic known as Syriac.
Oh, okay. So that's very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still people who speak that.
Yes.
But what I'm trying to get at is that when there was the split between the East and the West, and
An Eastern place.
This would have been an Orthodox place. Is there still an Orthodox patriarch there in Antioch?
Yes, uh-huh.
Oh, okay. All right. So you...
A lot of these places, though, have double patriarchates. If you go to Jerusalem, for example, there's an Orthodox patriarch of Jerusalem. There's also a Latin patriarch of Jerusalem.
Oh, I see. I see. And so you might find that in Antioch as well.
Yeah, I'd have to check.
Okay. And it's so just one more question about this. There...
Sudden intense interest in Antioch.
Yeah, but I'm getting somewhere with this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's this claim that there were these early patriarchates that are the major ones.
Right.
Like, and Antioch would have been one of those.
Correct.
Jerusalem.
Antioch. Alexandria, Rome, and Constantinople.
Because Constantinople,
yeah,
it's Istanbul now.
Yeah,
but
that's not just the business of the Turks.
No. All right, I got it, Jimmy. So is that a real thing though? Like these patriarchs are considered the main patriarchs?
There are certain patriarchates that have, for historical reasons, special dignity that they're accorded in the history of the church. They're important historical centers in the Christian faith. And some of them are specially connected to particular apostles or associates of an apostle, as in the case of Alexandria with Mark.
Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Don't forget, Jimmy Akin's book is out. You can buy it in bulk. You can buy a single copy if you want over at shop.catholic.com. And don't forget to check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It'll drop tomorrow, and it's on the weirdest thing that ever happened in Australia. One of the weirdest things that ever happened
in
Australia.
And Australia's a pretty weird place to start.
Well, yeah, that's true. Bee Gees. That's one of the greatest things that ever happened, the Bee Gees. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here. More Open Forum. If you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, 888-31-TRUTH.